Okay. Let me go ahead and get record going on the El Zumo.
Recording in progress.
There we go. All right. We are live. With
you
me.
Heard that talk, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it always tells me when it's recording. And I don't know if Mom, who has joined me for this episode, is getting senile or what, but she says she's seeing things in our Zoom. And she just asked me if I heard it say, "You are now recording." Yes.
Because it had balloons, it had confetti, it had bubbles.
Anyway.
And she can't see it, and I see him. She had to play it over. And then if it doesn't show to you, I need help.
I'm posting this video. 100%. It's going online. But Mom is with me. Normally, she's not insane. I guess no introduction is necessary because you've already started talking. So Mom is here. My name is Sherry. This is Outline of a Murder. Sister is not here. She is at a wedding. Chose a wedding over true crime. Whatever. And we're...
I think I did the true crime.
We're recording out of order as well because this case does involve the death of a teenager and a child. And so we don't, Elena doesn't like to do those cases where there's children involved. And so it's going to be me and Mom. And then tomorrow we're going to finish up our batch recording because they drop Halloween, which is Tuesday. So we're trying to get as many done as we can before we, you know, before that date arrives. That is the date. We just got
Sherry
done.
Does everything except we talk. So she has to edit, post her pictures. She has a lot to do.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as you think that we just get up here and talk. It is for me and Elena because we do nothing except talk. But Sherry, hours and hours and hours of work.
I'm going to go ahead and get everything prepared for the cases do today. That way I can get everything done by Tuesday. And good news, our merch is live. The store is live. We have 3 t-shirts. 1 t-shirt has several different colors of the same graphic. We've got our Be Smart, Be Rude, Don't Be a Victim signature shirt where we get a lot of compliments on. And then I have the mannequin shirt because it's never a mannequin, ever. If you see a body in the middle of nowhere, it is not a mannequin. Just go ahead and dial 911 and then they can examine the body because it's not a mannequin. I think there's like 1 case where it actually was a mannequin. Other than that, it's not. But this case, I've actually wanted to do for a very, very long time. This is the Larry Jean Bell case. We always end our season with a serial killer. And so this is the serial killer, Larry Jean Bell. I heard about it years ago. I never had time to dig into the case until I started the research. So I want to right off the bat recommend John Douglas's book, When a Killer Calls. It's a phenomenal book. It's where I got the title for these episodes or this episode. I'm not sure if it's going to be a one-parter or a two-parter. And I just couldn't think of a better one. You know, I couldn't think of a better title because that's exactly what he did, is he tormented the family of his victim, Sherry. And so we'll get to that, which is kind of weird that her name is my name. Now, I just have to say, the decade is 1985. That is me and Elena's decade, you know, big hair, Aquanet hairspray. Remember?
Yep.
You'd have the little wings on the side and the little doohickey thing on the bangs.
They used to call the wings feathered. You had your hair feathered.
Well, no. Now, see, we definitely feathered, but we used Aquanet on the sides to get it to stand out a little bit. Yes, yes. And then we would put Aquanet, I'm demonstrating on video for Mom, right here so our hair would be up. I did not do that one. I did do the sides. I will confess, full disclosure, Aquanet was my thing. It had like the pink purple color. We had Pac-Man. I used to play Pac-Man for hours at my stepmom's place of business, which happened to be a bar right across the street where we lived. I would go there after school and play Pac-Man. Very good at it. We had great bands like Tears for Fears, Prince, Simple Minds, and of course, the greatest president in history, Ronald Reagan. Okay.
Right.
So this is the background. It was also during this time, guys, that serial killers were out of control. The 70s and the 80s are called the golden age of serial killing or killers. Tech hadn't quite caught up. DNA wasn't even on people's radar. Now, it might have been in the 80s as time went on because that's when it was discovered. Cameras weren't everywhere.
In the 70s, we never thought of serial killers, and we hitchhiked and we walked alone and we did so much. And then as I got older, yeah, it was called the golden years for serial killers.
Right. Hitchhiking.
Yes.
Was a really easy way to get victims. People didn't lock their doors as much. They started locking them, though. They also, you know, I mean, people didn't have cell phones. You didn't have iPads. You didn't have any way to trace people. You couldn't even call anybody if you were in trouble. Like, you would have to find the nearest phone or the nearest payphone, which for people that are listening that don't know what a payphone is, I mean, picture this, guys. There was a box. It's a tall box. It has three sides of windows. You open the door, you get in there, and then there's this phone that's right on the back wall. And you put quarters, not credit cards. You had to actually have quarters to put in the phone to make a phone call.
And it would tell you if you're at your time because you had to pay for 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then say, please deposit, blah, blah, blah.
And if you didn't, click.
Yeah, yep. You're out.
You hear a dial tone. Some of you may not even know what a dial tone is.
Don't know what a phone booth is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's crazy to me.
And what made it even harder during the golden age of serial killing to get the killers is they were stranger on stranger, which are the most difficult to get. And, you know, one of our cases this season was Brian Koberger. He was caught because of technology. Back then, they didn't have it. And, I mean, you've got BTK, who killed a neighbor. And no one had any idea for decades. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it was the daughter who just happened to mention, did he kill our neighbor? And that's what put them on that case. They had no idea. So, you know, when you've got a typical killing, you've got people in their orbit that you can usually track down that were responsible for the murder. With serial killing, you don't. So that's the time frame. That's where we're living. I would say definitely 1985, you know, the decade of 80s, people were still very innocent when it came to killing, but we were starting to wise up. I was just a kid, though. I mean, I was only 12. I mean, would you say, you know, since you were an adult during that time?
About the 80s or 90s, I don't know which was worse, which one, 80s or 90s in fashion and hair and music.
Well, what about killing itself? I mean, did people lose some of their innocence by the 80s, you think, or mid 80s, or was it still pretty, you know?
I don't know. I know back then, 70s and 80s, there was a naiveness about people, trusting about people. Because even in the 80s, I left my doors unlocked. So did some of my neighbors.
I didn't.
I don't know.
Yeah, Dad taught me even back then. He would lock the doors. He would do. But, you know, he was a truck driver. He also sometimes found himself in, you know, areas that weren't that safe. So he was very, very cautious. But also he was a true crime guy. And so he locked things. He locked car doors and he would tell, you know, my stepmother to lock the doors. So he was definitely probably more safety conscious than some.
I wasn't until I started an interest in true crime.
Yeah. I think in the rural areas, man, that's a hard word. The country areas that Sherry and her family lived in, I don't think they locked their doors. I remember living in Childress, Texas, and my grandmother never locked her doors. I mean, we had to tell her, you need to lock the doors. And so, you know, that was definitely, like, if the big cities were more safety conscious, the country areas probably were not. And maybe even to this day, they're not. If you live in the country, you need to lock your doors. You need to be aware of your surroundings. There's way too many crime cases we've covered where it's out in the country. On May 31st, 1985, Sherry Smith pulled up to her family's mailbox, which was at the end of a long driveway about 700 feet from the house, in a somewhat remote area of Lexington, South Carolina, to grab the mail before she headed up to the house itself. She had just gotten back from a graduation pool party with one of her friends. She lived with her parents, Bob and Hilda, and her sister, Dawn. They were both close as sisters. The entire family was close. She was raised in a very loving Christian home, which will become important later. Her dad was a pastor at Lexington Baptist Church. What makes this case really sad is the victimology. She was excited to graduate. She was going to sing the national anthem at her graduation. Plus, she was getting ready for a class cruise to the Bahamas after graduation. She was also in a serious relationship with her boyfriend. Things really could not be more perfect. And it was a great time to be a 17-year-old. She seemed well-developed as a person, which, you know, sometimes, you know, pastor kid, they had a reputation of being wild and crazy. She was not that teenager. Let me show you a picture of her. And the 80s hair. There it is. There it is. Oh, I don't know why I'm taking my microphone off. So, yes. Yeah, see the little, okay, so you got the feathered, right? But notice this little thing right here. See that I'm showing you? That was the Aquanet, 100%, I bet. I mean, if I was to ask her parents, I'm sure she had the Aquanet. And
she is innocent.
And then here is the family, the parents, the brother, the two sisters. Here's another one that it looks like maybe a Bible, you know, they're going to church or something. And there's Sherry Little, definitely younger. That's her sister. Notice the hair thing. I'm telling you, we sprayed the Aquanet right there over by the ears. Yes. Yes.
You know, they still make that.
Yes, they do. I'm surprised that they do. Okay. Now you can see me, right? Did I turn off the screen share?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let me see if we have balloons this time.
Okay, that's people, you know, it's just, you're making the true crime awkward.
I'm sorry.
It's just, Continue. They don't know what the balloons are. I don't know what the balloons are. When you talk about balloons, they're going to think you're crazy. Okay? So let's keep these things to ourselves.
All right, close. My lips are sealed.
Now, before I continue, are you familiar with this case, the Larry Jean Bell killer?
No, I remember the name, and when you said they were tormented, the family, I remember a little. I usually don't know the cases that Sherry does, because okay. I like to give, you know, just talk about, you know, with that one, because if you're real prepared, everybody, it's just reading something. It's not, you know, the real reactions.
Yeah.
So I like to.
Well, I mean, just in general, you've heard of the phone calls, and so you've got a little bit of vague.
Okay.
So to recap, we've got Sherry. She comes home from a pool party with her friends. She's excited to graduate. She's excited to go on her cruise. She's excited to, you know, sing the national anthem. She pulls up, long driveway. She grabs the mail like any good kid. You know, she leaves the car running. She steps out of the car, grabs the mail, and then she should be at the house any minute. Bob and Hilda were at home when Sherry pulled up to the mailbox. Bob was in his office, so he had a view of the driveway, of the mailbox. He saw Sherry pull up, but he noticed that her car is still sitting at the end of the driveway when she should be at the house by this time. It's very sad. He wondered what was going on. You know, I'm sure he didn't think she had been taken or anything like that. Maybe she was having car trouble, you know, whatever. So he decides to go down to where her car is located, find out. When he got to her car, Sherry is gone. There's no sign of her. The car is still running. The driver's side door is still open. But what alarms him, her shoes and her purse are on the seat. So her shoes actually, I think, were either in the car or right outside the car. And then her purse is on the seat. He immediately felt something terrible had happened, so he went back to the house and called authorities. He did not waste any time at all. Hilda, a Sunday school teacher, asked Bob what was wrong. He said, "Honey, I don't know how to tell you this, But Sherry's car is at the end of the driveway running, and she is not in it.
Well, you may not got to that part yet, but
go ahead.
I wonder if it was someone they knew or someone that was watching her, or if it was just, you know, coincidental that, oh yeah, there's my next victim.
Well, we'll definitely get into it, but he is a serial killer. And I'm thinking there might be as many as four or five victims, but they can only tie them to two. One is Sherry's. Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Smith was definitely well known in his community. He was respected. He had lots of friends. The minute they find out Sherry is missing, they start a huge search, both by air and land resources. She wasn't found. Police set up a 24-hour command center in a tractor trailer near the house. No one had any idea where she was or why anyone would even take her. Like, was it ransom? Was it some pervert? You know, they have no idea. They just want to be prepared and ready in case, you know, they start getting a phone call from somebody. They were hoping that maybe a friend, you know, pulled up and they just, you know, she wasn't thinking and she got in the car. But, you know, they knew it was unlikely. They figured something really bad was happening here. It was a close-knit community. It was a small community. The family was absolutely devastated. They know something bad has happened. Yeah,
because it's a character, and she seemed like a real responsible young lady. Even if she had gone off with friends, she probably would have drove up to the house, let them know, dropped the mail, and then got in the car with them.
100%. She wouldn't have just left her car running and her purse and shoes. Yeah. They were a family of faith and prayer, and they took great strength from their faith. But, you know, no matter how much you love Jesus or how strong your faith is, the pain was excruciating. And you could see from the photo, like, if I go back to the photo, tell me your impressions of this family just by the photo. So let me get to the one where it's all of them. Like, what do you see here?
Happy, close-knit.
Yeah. I mean, the dad's laughing.
Happy, close-knit. Look at the dad. So proud.
Yeah. And it looks like something tickled them. You know, you can tell that, I mean, they're just, a happy family. Sherry is over, you know, on the left, smiling, looks a lot like her mother. You could tell that Dawn, the older sister, has a very sweet, sweet face.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is a good family, well-adjusted. 2 days after her disappearance, the phone rang in the Smith home. An anonymous caller asked for Hilda, the mother, and told her that he had Sherry. He described her black and yellow bathing suit that she had on under her clothes the day she disappeared. He also told them a letter was coming from Sherry and to expect it in the next couple of days. He also said that they were eating and watching TV, but he would not let Hilda speak to Sherry. He said that he would call back in a couple of days. No recording exists of this initial call. The police didn't want to wait for the letter, so they immediately contacted the postmaster to open up the post office and intercept the letter. The letter was in Sherry's handwriting, dated June 1st, 1985, and it was titled My Last Will and Testament. So I think I have the letter here in a photo. Yes. Okay, so here's the letter. And so you'll notice, again, written June 1st, 3:10 a.m., at the very top, she says, I love y'all, underlined a whole bunch of exclamation points. On the side is God is love. And she says, I love you, Mommy, Daddy, Robert, Don, and Richard, which was her boyfriend, and everyone else, and all other friends and relatives. I'll be with my father now. So please, please don't worry. Just remember my, let me see. I don't know if I have.
I have the letter after that.
Let's see. Please just remember my something and great special. Huh?
Isn't that my something? Is that personality or personal?
It looks like it might be in special times we all share together. Please don't ever let this ruin you, ruin your lives. Just keep living one day at a time for Jesus. Some good will come out of this. My thoughts will always be with you and in you. Casket closed, in parentheses. I love you all so damn much. Sorry, Daddy, I had to cuss for once. Jesus, forgive me. Richard, sweetie, I really did and always will love you and treasure our special moments and ask one thing, that you accept Jesus as your personal Savior, my family, something, I can't read it. I'm sorry if I, let me move our things, I can't see. I am sorry if I ever disappointed you in any way. I only wanted to make you proud of me because of, I can't read that. Mom, Dad, Robert, and Dawn, there's so much I want to say that I should have said before now. Before now, I love you. I know you'll love me and will miss me very much, but if y'all stick together, let's see, like we always did, you can do it. Please don't become hard or upset. Everything works out for the good of those who love the Lord. All my love, always. I love y'all with all my heart. Sharon, Sherry Smith, P.S. Nana, I love you so much. Kind of always felt like you, and I can't read the rest. So, she
write her letter.
Huh?
So he let her write the goodbye letter.
Yeah, yeah, and she knows she's going to die. Yeah. So basically, she's wanting them to not become bitter, to rely on one another and how much she loves them.
That sort of tells you how she is, though. Not only how much she loves them, but please do this for yourself and don't forget God and stick together. I mean, she's thinking of them, too.
Yeah, and the bravery and the concern.
Yes.
Okay. Now, after this, they get the letter. They get another phone call from him. So let me play this. It's on True Crime Garage. When a Killer Calls, part 1 through 3, starting with episode 553. You can listen to the phone calls. John Douglas is interviewed in these episodes, and he released them to TCG.
What was that?
Hello?
Have you received the mail today?
Yes, I have.
Do you believe me now?
Well, I'm not really sure I believe you because I haven't had any word from Sherry. And I need to know that Sherry is well.
You'll know in 2 or 3 days.
Why 2 or 3 days?
Call the search off.
Tell me if she is well because of her disease. Are you taking care of her?
On.
Yes?
Did you come down from Charlotte?
Yes, I did. Who's calling, please?
I need to speak to your mother.
Okay, get my mother. She's coming.
Tell her to hurry.
She's hurrying. Tell Sherry I love her.
Did y'all receive her letter today?
Yes, we did. Here's mother.
Did you receive her letter today?
This is Hilda.
Did you receive Sherry Ray's letter?
Pardon? I can't hear you. That is not very clear. Speak louder.
Did you receive the letter today?
Yes, I did.
Tell me one thing it said.
Tell you one thing it said?
Anything.
Sher Richard?
Did what?
There was a little heart on the side, Sher Richard, written on the side. It said...
How many pages?
2 pages.
Okay, it's yellow legal pad.
Yeah.
And on one side on the front page it said, Jesus is love.
No, God is love.
Well, God is love.
Right.
Okay, so you know now that this is not a hoax call.
Yes, I know that.
Okay. We missed Sheriff Mitz this morning.
I don't know what happened to that. They couldn't get him on.
Okay. I'm trying to do everything possible to answer some of your prayers, so please, in the name of God, work with us here.
Can you answer me one question, please? You are very kind, and you seem to be a compassionate person, and I think you know how I feel being Sherry's mother and how much I love her. Can you tell me, is she all right physically without her medicine?
Sherry is drinking a little over 2 gallons of water per hour and using the bathroom right afterwards.
All right. Is she able to eat? Because she doesn't usually eat. That's what concerns
no.
me.
Listen, I got to hurry now.
I know that.
Okay, now, what I'm going to do is have an ambulance. Now, this is very important. This has gone too far. Please forgive me. Have an ambulance ready at any time at your house.
Have an ambulance ready, then.
On Sherry's request.
It's hard to hear it.
Only immediate family come and Sheriff Metz and the ambulance attendants. She don't want to make a circus out of this.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
And where she said, casket closed in parentheses.
Right.
If anything happens to me, she said one of her requests she did not put in there to put her hands on her stomach like she was praying in the casket.
What, ma'am?
Cross her hands.
Why would anything happen to you? We don't want any harm to you. I promise. We just want Sherry well and all right, okay?
Okay, now, does Sheriff Metz realize that this is not the hoax call?
Yes, he knows this is not a hoax.
Okay, well, tell him to just forget about all other suspects. And the only thing, when I talked to you Monday morning, 2:30 in the morning,
yes.
The first time?
Yes, I did not realize, I thought you were a police officer.
Okay, listen real carefully. I got to hurry. I know these calls are being traced, correct?
I do not know.
They are. Okay. Now listen.
I'm listening.
Yeah, hold on a sec.
Are you still there?
Yes. Okay, hold on just a sec.
Is Sherry with you? Or can you tell me that?
I will not say it.
I can tell you're upset.
Oh, yes. Okay, hold on before I forget it. I told you that morning you were looking at the wrong place, right?
Yes, you did.
I wish you would have remembered that. I don't know
why. I did remember that.
Okay, well, listen to us, please. Okay, forget Lexington County. Look in Saluda County. Do you understand?
Look in Saluda County.
Exactly. The closest to Lexington County, within a 15-mile radius right over the line. Is that understood?
Yeah.
And please, and very, very soon, please, now Sherry's request, no strangers, hardly, and when we give the location.
No strangers, absolutely.
Okay. Now, did you understand about the folding of the hands, like she was in prayer in case something happens to us?
Yes, if something happens to y'all. But
right.
Nothing, listen, nobody is going to harm you. I promise you that.
Sheriff Mitz, that. I don't know what the problem is. I told you to forget about looking around your house. Saluda County.
Listen. There
Do
are,
you believe me now?
I believe you. There are so many people
that
love Sherry, and they just won't give up.
Sherry,
they
I want to tell you one other thing. Sherry is now part of me. Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, our souls are one now.
Your souls are one now with Sherry?
Yes, and we're trying to work this out. So please do what we ask. You haven't been doing it. I don't understand. And she doesn't. We sit here and watch TV. We see no sheriff.
Why does hasn't Sherry talked to me. She knows me so well.
That's why she asked me to communicate with you, not your husband. Aren't you aware of that?
Yes, I know that. I know that she would ask you to talk with me.
She does love y'all. And like she said, do not let this ruin your lives.
We're not going to let it ruin our...
Okay, well,
but you tell Sherry one thing.
What is that?
There's no way my life could ever have any happiness in it again if Sherry left this world with me bearing a guilt that I had felt in such a bad way, because I love her and I want to make her happy. I'll do anything to work it out. She doesn't have to come home, okay? I'm serious. She does not have to come home. Anything.
Well, time's up, and please now have the ambulance ready at any time.
This at any
will
time.
Not go any further, and it will be soon.
The ambulance, you're not telling me that something's going to happen to her and I'm going to have an ambulance.
I'm telling you her condition.
Is getting bad. Is that what
you know more about it than I do.
I know I do, and that's why I am so worried about it.
Well, you have the ambulance, and I'll give you the location and tell Sheriff Mitz to get all his damn men in Saluda County. Okay, well, God bless all of you.
Will you call me soon?
I will.
Will you call me back tonight? I just need reassurance to know that she's still okay.
I have
okay.
to be careful. I got to go now, and listen, please forgive me for this. It just got out of hand.
I know. Listen, do me one thing.
What is that? Hurry.
Just tell Sherry. I know she knows how much I love her. Tell her daddy loves her, and her daddy will work anything out with her under the sun, and he admits we've got a lot of problems, and we'll work them out, and her brother and sister love her. And God bless you for taking care of my baby.
Sherry is protected, and like you said, she is a part of me now. And God look after all of us.
Yeah.
Good night.
Good luck.
What are your impressions?
You know, I couldn't hear a lot of it because it was, number one, it didn't sound like his voice was, changed. I would think someone could recognize him. But when the sister asked if she was okay and the mother asked, there was a long pause. I think she was already dead.
Yeah, and then he said, she's already a part of me physically, mentally, all that. And then our soul's one. And then notice how he's bringing God into it, because he knows this is a God-fearing family. Yeah, he's a piece of crap.
Yep.
Now, the situation that was concerning the mother is Sherry suffered from diabetes insipidus. It's a rare form of the disease that requires massive hydration and medicine. Her medicine was found in her purse, so this meant that Sherry didn't have her medicine, and that alone could kill her. The caller assured Hilda that she was drinking plenty of water.
Yes, I heard that part.
But not 2 gallons an hour. There's no way.
I heard that, and I'm like, there's no way.
I
think she's already dead.
I looked it up. It's where the kidneys are unable to retain water. So where diabetes mellitus is a condition characterized by the inability of the body to produce enough or respond normally to insulin, causing blood sugar levels to be high, the one that she had is where she has the massive dehydration if she doesn't have her medicine. So I doubt that water alone would have been enough for her. But what intrigued the investigators from the start, and also what got John Douglas involved, is the killer didn't ask for anything. He didn't ask for money. He didn't ask for anything except that they quit looking for her in Lexington County. So what do you think about that?
I think to me that would mean she's in Lexington County.
Exactly. It's like he's trying to get them away from where he's already probably dumped the body.
But what's weird too, though, it makes you wonder, was it one time religious family or something? Because, or was he just playing a game with the religion? I mean, why call and then talk like you're such a, you know, God loves everybody. God, you know.
Well, he's God a typical fearful. Serial killer. They're master manipulators and they just are chameleons.
Wanted to torture, yeah.
Absolutely. He didn't ask for ransom money. He didn't ask for anything that, except that listeners answer his questions and listen carefully. And so that's, again, when they got John Douglas involved. He said, I've never had a case like this before where the offender doesn't make it clear what he wants. Does he want ransom? Is it sexually motivated? He doesn't just want to commit this crime. He wants to toy with the victim's families, giving them false hope that their child is still alive. This... This is a sadist. So everybody knows this is a sadist. A sadist takes pleasure in torturing their victims. That's the biggest bang for their buck, is torturing the victim or torturing the victim's family. In this case, it's part of the fantasy. It's the need for power. I also wanted to point out that long pause where he kept saying, hang on. He wants to control the situation. So I don't know if when he was on the phone, because it sounded like he was in a public place, if someone was walking by and he had to wait for them to get past, or if he was reading from scripts or notes. But something was threatening his control of the conversation, and he had to wait until he got control again.
It didn't sound to me like he had notes, so I just wonder if someone walked by. But he did ask for something. He asked, don't look in this county.
Yeah, but, you know, the typical, like, ransom, yeah, things like that. Right. Later, I mean, the phone calls continued until he was caught. The later ones involved Sherry's older sister, Dawn, and he started confusing the two. So, wow. It's clear that at this point, I don't know if he got Dawn, like he thought he got Dawn, but he got Sherry, or he killed Sherry and then he started fantasizing about Dawn. But they wondered, you know, some wondered, was she the intended victim? I don't know if she was, but there were several times he wanted to talk with her, and the police are there. They're coaching her. She wrote a book about it later, so it was one of the most difficult things she's ever gone through. He did initially alter his voice, and then later he didn't at all.
I think he intended to get Sherry, but when the calls and he would get involved and talk to the sister, then that's the next one he wanted to do. Even if he couldn't get her, terrorize her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The behavior so far, the abduction, the victimology, from all of those things, John Douglas developed a criminal profile. He said that he would be a white male, because most offenders like that stay in their race. He said he would be early to late 30s. Mr. Douglas said that he usually starts at the age of 25 when he does his profiles, and then he'll take away some years or he'll add some years based on the sophistication of the crime, because most serial killers average about 25, and this crime was sophisticated, so he made him older than 25. He was local to the area, and that was probably due to how remote it was and the phone calls. And he said he's an electrician.
Oh.
I thought that was interesting. He said the reason he decided he was an electrician is because of the voice altering device. You know, most wouldn't know how to. Well, maybe in 85. I don't know if they could or not, but it probably wasn't something that was easy to use. Or that people might even think about using a device. They may alter their voice by holding something over it, or, you know, but he was actually using an electronic device. He also said that he would have a prior criminal history with similar offenses, including sex crimes, that he'd have a failed marriage in his past. Douglas said that he would be above average in intellect and that he was obsessive compulsive. So you can hear that. He's very precise. And I wondered if there was a script as well.
Douglas, he's profiled a lot of killers. And, you know, he's almost right on all of them.
Yeah.
He's wrote some books. He's really interesting.
Oh, his books are good. Every book I've read is really, really good.
He was also in a true crime show. I forgot the name of it.
I don't remember that. I know they did Mindhunters after him.
Maybe it was that. Yeah. And he was talking about a murder or a situation where he was at a barbecue or something. And I never saw the show, but he's very interesting.
Well, Mindhunters is fictional, but it was based on him and the other FBI profilers, and he also consulted for the show. They traced the call, one of the calls, to a payphone outside Eckerd's in the Lexington Town Square shopping center. Of course, the perpetrator is gone by the time they get there. On June 5th, 1985, investigators found her exactly where the perpetrator said that she would be. She had actually died 2 hours after writing her letter on June 1st. The killer waited to reveal where he had disposed of her so that decomp would obscure forensic evidence. And I think that's why he got agitated when they were searching for her, because they were too close, because he did dump her body, but he was trying to get them away from where it was so that it would decompose. Plus, it's summer. South Carolina is humid. Duct tape was wrapped around her face, indicating that she suffocated with the duct tape, but they also couldn't, you know, eliminate that she maybe died of dehydration because of the diabetes. The autopsy also couldn't tell them if she was sexually assaulted, but based on the criminology and some circumstantial evidence they discovered later, he was later charged with rape. The killer also described on the phone calls, again, they're all on TCG, about raping and sodomizing her. So he's basically, in the later calls, he describes, he says she was given three options on how she wanted to die and that she picked the duct tape. No, she wouldn't have.
She wouldn't have.
He
'Cause that's
also.
torture. I mean, it's interesting, sort of like a coward, you know. You wrap her face and let that her die, but watching her die and
That's a good
struggle.
point. Well, and plus the sadist likes the torture. Also, he
You know,
just.
back then, they didn't have a lot of cameras back then either, you know, because going to the phone booth, you know, they didn't have cameras like they do today.
He also described raping and sodomizing her in the phone calls.
Crazy.
And they didn't stop. And he actually called collect the night of Sherry's funeral to describe how he killed her.
What a horrible person.
I want to know when he spotted her. I'm like you. So Sherry had gone into town with her mom earlier that day to buy traveler's checks for the trip that she was going to take, you know, the cruise. Did he spot her then? Or had he been stalking her for a while? We know that BTK stalked his victims for a good long time. Was he stalking Dawn and thought that's who he had taken? Like I said before, I've never had those questions answered. Even in the book, they don't know how he spotted her because he never confessed to killing her. But I'm thinking at the very least, he spotted her that day.
And he didn't live around there. I don't think he stalked her because.
Yeah, he did. He lived in the, he was local to the area.
Oh, well, there you go then. Maybe it was just by chance he's going home or to a friend's on that road, maybe. Because I don't
Well,
think he stalked her because
or he
he
saw her
didn't
in
have the patience.
town. No, he has the patience.
You think?
He 100%. Why would you think he's impatient?
Just the things he was saying on the phone, and he got so impatient with the mother.
Well, yeah, because he wants
Oh,
to control.
yeah.
He's trying to follow his script. He has OCD. It wasn't
Well, that.
impatience. It was she's asking him questions and he's trying to go by a script. I think at the very least he spotted her that day and he followed her car back. If and I know that she went to a pool party. So I don't know. We just know that somewhere he saw her and he followed her to the house, obviously, because that's where he snatched her.
Right. I
On
agree.
June 14th at 4 p.m., 2 weeks after Sherry was taken, 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick was outside playing with her 3-year-old brother in the front yard of her family's trailer in Richland County, about 24 miles from Sherry's home. A neighbor observed a man driving a silver car drive rapidly into the trailer park past the Helmick trailer and then his trailer, and then he turned around and he stopped near the children. The man suddenly gets out of the car, walks toward the kids, grabbed Deborah around the waist, ran back to his car with Deborah kicking and screaming. He threw her in the car. She continued screaming and struggling, including kicking the roof of the car, and he drove away. So let me show you a picture of little Deborah.
Horrible that would be.
There she is. Look familiar?
She sort of looks like the last victim.
Yeah. Blonde, long blonde hair, looks very similar to Sherry's. So now we've got a type, right? We've got a killer that is grabbing blonde, victims. And here, this one's 9. Sherry was obviously 18.
You may get to this. I don't know. But, you know, there's a type there. I'm wondering who in his past he sees through them. You know what I mean?
If at all. He may just have a type. No, yeah. He would never talk. We don't know. We don't know why he picked his victims.
Oh.
Yeah. We don't. He would never admit to it. He would describe the bad guy that maybe did these things, but he would never open up at all.
He didn't admit to any or just the 9-year-old?
None of it.
Wow.
And the neighbor.
Killed that little girl. He never admitted to killing the little girl.
Right. Well, there are actually were potentially 2.
Yeah.
There's the 5-year-old, and then there was the 12 or 13-year-old where he wouldn't talk about her. So the neighbor ran outside. He attempted to stop the car. Bell accelerated and drove out of the park. The neighbor got about 40 feet from the car. He did notice the license plate started with a D, that it was a South Carolina tag. He then ran over to the helmet trailer, and he let the dad know what happened. 8 days later, the perpetrator called the Smith family.
Oh, my God.
Sherry's family, to give them precise directions to Deborah's call.
I wonder why he kept calling them. Well, number one, they probably, in the phone book, your number was everywhere. But why he didn't call the little girl's family?
I have no idea. He just is fascinated with Sherry Smith's family.
Yeah.
And
maybe they sound a little welcoming and not, you know, I don't know, trying to be nice because to get information out of him.
Yeah.
That God loves you. And I mean, I don't know.
Which he would perceive as weakness.
Yeah.
And that he could torture him.
Yeah. That's true, too.
So he led them to where, well, didn't lead them, but directed them to where her body was found badly decomposed in Lexington County, June 22nd. She was still clothed in her tank top, shorts, cotton panties, but over her panties were a pair of silk adult bikini briefs. Douglas later said he believes a perpetrator did that to hide the fact that he raped and killed a little girl. Investigators found the same adhesive material in Deborah's hair and that she, like Sherry, had been suffocated.
I wonder how far away the death spots were.
That's a good question. I mean, she's in the same county. And I wonder if the way he had abducted her was similar. And I wonder if Sherry was little.
Well, she looked little in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, slight, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you had kids, when you had Kent, you could just pick them up and carry them on your side, you know, like.
Yeah.
And they're hanging sideways. And
yeah. And
so that he might be tall. He might be strong.
And then if you look at, like, you know, you mentioned, well, did he just happen to spot her? It does make you wonder if he's trolling. I think going into a trailer park, you're going to find kids, at least back then, out playing. Could he not find an adult victim? So he went ahead and looked for just a kid that looked similar to what, you know, his type was. So it does make you wonder if he's more of an opportunistic killer. Or did he spot the little girl? In this case, I think it was opportunity. Because remember, he was driving past fast and then stops, turns around. And
at any given time in a neighborhood, especially after school, certain hours, you're going to find kids out playing. And parents are inside because it was safer then, or they thought.
It was. And I think he's devolving. Like the hurried nature, the way he grabbed her, there's witnesses, there's another kid out. He's definitely devolving as a killer.
And he'll get caught because he's getting sloppy.
He is. And the calls continued even after, you know, little Deborah was taken. So despite their incredible pain with losing Sherry, Don, who was now his focus at this point, agreed to continue talking with the perpetrator when he called, which led him to give directions to Deborah's body. So evidence is piling up at this point. They also were able to do a sketch of the suspect because of the neighbor that saw him take Deborah.
It's just the family taking those calls and another body. I mean, how heroic and how brave. I mean, because they had an agenda, too, to find out who he is.
And there's no pain greater than losing a child. And I would say to murder would be the worst.
Oh, yeah, because you'd live with that all your life. Mm-hmm. You know, because you're not there, you're the parent.
Well, yeah, but just the death of a child is scientifically the worst death to feel. And just it being probably magnified.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus like, you know, a sickness or a car wreck or something that she was, you know, she suffered.
What great people, though, to talk to that guy, especially after the death of their daughter.
Yeah.
I mean,
they wanted him caught.
I know. That's just so, that's wonderful to me, the courage they had to do that.
Yeah. And numerous tips came in at this point. The community was on high alert. Any man that had a beard was suspect. In the meantime, investigators are going over Sherry's letter with a fine-tooth comb, and they noticed some indentions on the paper. And I remember learning this in school where you'd get a pencil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you could see what was written. Well, that's what they did. They go over these indentions, and they discovered a phone number. The phone number led the police to a very nice couple named Ellis and Sharon Shepherd, who had been out of town during the abductions, but they had a man house-sitting named Larry Jean Bell. So investigators were able to tie some of the phone calls to the Shepherd's home phone. They also found a roll of 22-cent USPS commemorative Mallard Duck stamps in one of the Shepherd's drawers that matched the one that was on the last will and testament envelope. They also found blonde hair similar to Sherry's in the bathroom. The Ellises also identified Bell's voice in the recordings and his handwriting. On top of that, Bell had worked as an electrician on some construction sites for Ellis, and they knew him well. So remember Hunter Douglas, or John Douglas, said that. They told police that when Larry picked them up at the airport, he talked a lot about Sherry's abductions. Investigators believe that he saw Sherry running errands in town and grabbed her, took her to the Shepherd's and tied her up and raped her before wrapping her head with duct tape, suffocating her.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
So he was arrested June 27th driving a grayish. Remember, it was a silver car, 1978 Riviera, with a license plate that read OCH241. Now remember, the witness to Deborah's abduction said that it started with a D, not an O. Well, in the trunk, they found a second license plate that read DCE604. The registration card in the vehicle confirmed that that was actually the license plate for the car, not the OCH241, which was probably stolen. So all of these are important because later Bell would try to act insane in court, and he just incessantly disrupted the proceedings to convince the jury that he was insane and he didn't know what he was doing. Well, he knew what he was doing to change the plate on the car because I bet you he saw the guy getting that license plate, like watching it closely as he drove off.
And thought, but how long before he was, after the murders, was he arrested? Do you know?
That was June 27th. And Deborah, so that was the 27th, and Deborah was taken the 14th.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So not too long. Now, later, you know, he testified for 6 hours in court, blurting out these bizarre comments and statements. He refused to answer questions. He rambled continuously. He continued the charade while in prison by smearing feces all over himself and drinking his own urine. Everybody's like, yeah, he's trying to play that he's insane and have grounds for appeal.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the judge instructed the jury, like he said, he believes it's an act, and he had to instruct the jury that that was not evidence and they could not include his statement in belief for or against bail because the judge isn't supposed to say stuff like that. So he clarified it so he couldn't get off on appeals later. He also tried to say that by including the tapes in both trials, especially Deborah's, that was bringing prior bad acts that tainted the jury. This was denied because they were very careful not to include any of Sherry's parts in the calls, just Deborah's. And then in Sherry's trial, just Sherry's.
Oh, that's smart.
Now, according to law, you can have mental issues or even insanity, but if at the time of the crimes you clearly exhibited the ability to know right from wrong, you could not use that as a defense. The phone calls, the altering of his voice, calculating when to reveal the bodies so he could destroy physical evidence, changing his license plate, and more clearly showed that he knew that what he did was wrong and the jury agreed. He was convicted in June of 86 for Sherry's death and sentenced to death. He was then convicted of Deborah's death in 1987 and sentenced to death. He claimed to be Jesus Christ even up to his execution October 4th, 1996. He chose the electric chair, remember he's an electrician, versus lethal injection. Douglas believes it was so he could be the tough guy up until the end.
Wow, what a narcissist.
Now here's something that's interesting. So even with all that circumstantial evidence, you know, they're trying to get a confession out of him. And right. Douglas recommended that they set up this situational task force trailer with all of the appropriate evidence so he could see it, all the paraphernalia, so that Bell would feel super important. What Douglas didn't know is they were actually going to bring Bell to him and his partner. So Douglas tried to get
I didn't know that.
And they're like, they're just sitting there and they're like, hey, talk to, you know, and he's all, I mean, he wasn't prepared at all. So he tried to get a confession using the tactic of the good Larry Jean Bell and the bad Larry Jean Bell. Bell didn't fall for it. He did allude to the idea that if he had done these terrible things, it would definitely be the bad Larry Jean Bell.
Well, I would think so, yeah.
They also discovered that he did have a history of obscene phone calls. So who exactly is this poop bird? So let's end with the crime, the criminal aspect. So he was born October 30th, 1949 in Ralph, Alabama. He was not a popular kid. Let me just show you some pictures while I'm describing this guy. So this is him.
Looks like a kid that would be bullied when he was younger.
Yeah. Not saying that means he's going to turn into a killer. But no. He was in the Navy. And there he is there. He played baseball in high school, but that didn't get him friends. His parents, they were a nice, respectable couple, but they did say he was a loner. There are rumors that he would fall into trances and that as a teenager, he sexually abused some of his female relatives, but I could not confirm this. He worked for Eastern Airlines in Charlotte for a time. He went through a bitter divorce, just like John Douglas said, and lost custody of his son. By the time he was 26, he began assaulting and beating others of a high and aggravated nature, and I'm assuming his victims were females. We know that one victim, 19-year-old Dale Howell, who Bell tried to abduct using a knife, telling her he wanted to party with her in Charlotte. He also tried to abduct a female university student in South Carolina at gunpoint, and then after a third attack for a similar crime, he spent 3 years in prison. The judge urged him to get psychiatric help. He obviously didn't. Now, to those who he liked, he seemed like a kind and helpful person. What's interesting is I'm assuming people thought he was probably odd. His mother said, quote, "We accepted him the way any family would accept a child. They say that all children are different." Now, he cracked his knuckles, shook with laughter, and cried silently when the tapes were being played in the courtroom.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know why he lost custody of his child, and if there was abuse in the marriage.
Yeah.
It seems pretty violent. I'm sure there was. That's crazy.
And then,
did you say there was more victims, they thought?
Yeah. Yeah, I just read of the ones that he tried, but I think he actually two more, actually, which I'll get
balloons
into in a second.
Coming up again.
What?
Balloons are popping up again.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So the Smiths did as well as could be expected, you know, after. This is Dawn today. She became Miss South Carolina of 1986, and she's now an inspirational speaker. And I think actually she's divorced now, unfortunately. Pretty. Yeah, she is. Now, a lot of potential other victims are from the Crime Junkie podcast. And let's see. The first one is Denise Porch from Charlotte, North Carolina in 1975. This would have been when Bell was 26 years old, okay? What was his connection? Did he know her? Did he live in the area? The husband noted that her purse was in the apartment, which was unusual. She always took her purse, and she was one of the property managers, so when she would show an apartment, even then she would take her purse. Like, it was always with her. Between 2 to 3, she was seen showing an apartment to 2 to 3 men. A witness saw her a little after 3 driving away from the model apartment with a young man in the passenger seat of her vehicle. He then saw her return 10 to 15 minutes later. At 3:20, the witness saw Denise walking out of a model of apartment with a man to a dark sedan. He was in his mid-20s, dark hair, and well-dressed. Another witness who worked at a nearby gas station said he gave directions to 2 men to the complex. Another witness says that on I-77, she saw a woman that looked like Denise running down the road, and chasing her was a man in a dark sedan. The man was white with dark hair and a slender build. The police felt that it was credible, but when the other people in the car with this lady were questioned, they don't remember seeing the woman running down the highway. A week later, another resident described seeing the same man. Gail Lucas at 2:30 had her doorbell ring. She said he had a mustache. The man said that as soon as he saw her, he apologized and said it was the wrong apartment. She saw him later in the same dark sedan. Gail did a composite. They had one with the mustache and one without, and they put it out to the media. They got a call from the man claiming to be the guy, Steve Caldwell. He said that he did visit the complex. He goes down to the station driving a dark sedan. He got there at 5 p.m., not 2:30, and that he did go to the wrong apartment. He said that he was there to see a coworker, and he never saw Denise. Then, and they cleared him.
Yeah.
On August 10th, Denise's uncle gets a phone call and says he has Denise and that he'd release her if he could get $50,000. They think it's one of those crank calls that people do when they see a crime.
Yes.
So they tapped the phone. The person called multiple times and also sent a letter. So it sounds like Bell. You know, you got the letter. You got the phone calls.
Oh, yep.
Well, on September 10th, they do catch the guy making the call, and his name is Edsel Brown, but he denies taking Denise. They investigate. They find out he's a poop bird, but they cleared him of Denise.
Oh.
Larry Gene Bell was living 300 yards from Denise's apartment complex when she disappeared.
Well, we know that's probably who took her.
Yeah. And he denied anything to do with it. But on December 18th, 1980, a man was walking in the woods near Charlotte. He sees something in front of him. He finds bones. An electric cord is wrapped around the neck. Remains of a young female in her teens or early 20s. After a few weeks, they identify her as Beth Hagen. and she was last seen in August. So it wasn't Denise. It was another lady.
Wow.
The final one, and we have less information on her, is Sandy Elaine Cornett, also from Charlotte in 1984. Sandy was an insurance adjuster who did not show up at work the next morning. Michael, I believe that's her husband, called the neighbor and asked her to check on her because he was out of town. The front door was unlocked, which was a huge no-no for Sandy. She was super safety conscious. The TV was on. Michael reports her missing, and they felt that something was wrong based on the scene. There were no signs of a struggle, so he comes back. He notes a missing recorder and a missing credit card. They also believe that due to her safety consciousness, she knew her abductor, and they wondered if the recorder was taken because maybe something was on it, like the voice of the killer.
Voice, yeah. I wonder, it's interesting, he killed one with a wire strangulation, but wrapped the last two.
Maybe, if he did do it. I mean, I've heard of crazy stuff where it actually ends up being several killers, not the same one.
That's true.
But
phone calls, though, to the family.
Yeah. And, I mean, just because she is safety conscious, though, I don't know if that means she would know him.
No, that doesn't mean. I've seen people safety conscious, and I've been around people that are. Someone knocks on the door, and they open the door.
I know. And I'm like.
And they take all these safety measures. I'm like, what do you unlock the door?
Exactly.
And I said, don't open the door.
Yep.
When someone knocks on the door that late.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't open the door. Now, a few days later, a person who sounded like a lady called the bank for her balance, but Sandy kept meticulous records. So her card was used on the 18th, four times on the 20th. And the reason they knew it wasn't Sandy is because of her record keeping. She wouldn't have called for the balance. Two people were using it, a clean-shaven man and a woman that was about 5'7 with shoulder-length brown hair. Both were driving two different cars, but it's clear they knew each other. The one was driving a North Carolina license plate car. After this, the case goes cold. Bell lived just 4 miles from Sandy's house. He knew Sandy.
Yeah, but do you think, though, he would have an accomplice?
No. He knew, but what if they found her card? What if it wasn't the killer? What if they found her card?
That's true, too.
But Sandy had met Larry through a former boyfriend, and he had been in her house a few years before for a birthday party. I personally don't think that one's Larry Jean Bell. I do believe the woman and the man had something to do with her disappearance.
Yeah, because Bell wouldn't have waited a year to kill her.
However, when interviewed, he said he did know something about her murder, and that if God let it, he'd tell him more. And he did say they found her body with her hands together.
Oh.
In 1992, a man called police saying that 8 years ago, a man named Larry Bell drove him and another man to a well in Cherokee County and said he put the bodies there. Both men corroborated the story, but they only found animal bones. So it's a possibility. I don't think it's a for sure thing.
I know. It is a possibility because there are a few things that are the same or similar.
But like I've said,
things that aren't similar. So
exactly. Now we do know that killers do evolve in their MO and their weapon of choice. But yeah, I definitely
don't think he'd have a woman accomplice.
No, I don't think he'd have an accomplice at all. Mm-mm. No way. No. So what do you think?
I think it's just bizarre. The phone calls to the family, even to torture. And didn't really change his voice. It just, I don't know. You know, had it not been for that letter he let her write, he may not have been caught right away like that.
Yes.
You know, rubbing the letter with the pencil. We used to do that all the time.
And what I wonder is, okay, where the house was, it was definitely in a less populated area. But was there enough traffic where Sherry didn't notice she was being followed? Or was she so unaware because she felt so safe?
I think that. I think she felt so safe.
And so that's the thing. We obviously like to give tips. It doesn't matter where you live.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter if you live in a city, if you live in the country. It doesn't matter. If someone spots you, you know, that's what That's why you always have to be aware of your surroundings. Always, always. Like one of the things I'll do is if I see a car that's been behind me for a while, I'll go all over the place.
I do too.
There's no way I'm going to take them home.
This happened the other day. Someone was sitting in his truck and he couldn't see inside. And he'd been out there a while when I was calling on this store for work. And then when I left, he did. So I watched behind me the whole time. And then he turned off to go into a house. But yeah, you have to be aware for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, back then everyone felt safe, didn't pay attention. People, I mean, they didn't even lock their doors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of people even to this day say, you never think it happens to you. And I've noticed, I don't know if you have, there's been a lot of cases lately where it's sort of in these rural areas and country areas where people have been murdered.
There's actually quite a bit of them. I mean, that makes sense, right? Because there's not a lot of people around. People feel safer. I don't know why. You're out in the middle of the boonies. I wouldn't feel safer. And so they just don't think, you know.
Safe.
Yeah.
You're not safe anywhere. You have to be aware. You have to.
Always. Always be aware of your surroundings, no matter where you're at. Even church, the store, the parking lot, your house. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't mean bad things don't happen.
Right. Yeah. All right. Yeah. It's time for the tagline. You have to do both of Elena's.
Be smart and be rude.
And don't be a victim. Outline of a Murder is a Mr. Joseph production. What do you think, Joseph?